Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Douglas Headley. I serve as Executive Director of the Canadian Faculties of Agriculture and Veterinary Medicine. Between all of those 13 institutions in Canada, they represent about 45% of all publicly funded research in agriculture and food. Before I start the question period, I really must extend my thanks to Chandra for the vision and enthusiasm that he has brought to these conferences, and to congratulate him as well on the launch of the Global Food Security Institute that we saw on Tuesday night. It's a remarkable achievement. I want to start by looking at all three conferences and where we are now. The first Global Food Security Conference here in McGill took place in 2008 at the height of the food crisis, or the food price crisis, whichever you wish. It was used to identify the problem, to look at awareness of the problem, the role of science, and the need for political commitment in dealing with it. It defined the boundaries. And as I say, it took place in a time of crisis. In the second conference last year, we explored the proximate causes of the food crisis. We also began to look at the underlying causes, those long-term issues that were not being addressed adequately to either prevent the crisis or to solve or meet the Millennium Development Goals for 2015 of having the poor and food insecure in the world. We looked at productivity growth. We looked at the role of markets. We looked at the role of what institutions were doing in a crisis. In this conference, I've been really pleased to see the extension outward to all of the linkages across disciplines, regions, resources, water, food security, and nutrition. Those issues that we've gone through are healthcare, education, climate change, both mitigation and adaptation, infrastructure, governance, socioeconomic stability, nutrition, the variation of nutrition within species and across species and their role in diets, interventions in health and lending and nutrition, what works and what doesn't, public and private sector linkages, particularly the speech by Dr. Campos yesterday, the role of water availability in responding to crisis. What we have seen this morning in our speakers is really adding to what we have heard in this conference by bringing in the role of institutions both in crisis and in the long term. Rebecca Young has offered us some ideas, and I stress their ideas, as she did, of how do we move from here now that we have dealt with or succeeded in dealing with the crisis, to move toward long-term sustainable commitment in both public and private and multilateral organizations to correct the kind of market failure that she has defined. Cheryl Morden at EFAD has given us the history of the capability in dealing with the rural poor and bringing them out of poverty. Building programs and focusing attention on ideas, changing operations with experience, and funding and building the link between the poor and the agri-food value chain network in the world. Chris Delgado, what he has done is brought to us the experience of the World Bank in response to crisis, the resounding message that we're getting from Chris is that institutions can respond in crisis. In other words, they don't waste a good crisis to cut through red tape and get on with the job. He also talks about the difficulties in long-term approaches, multi-institutional, and the low glamour of long-term commitment that really has infected many of our donor agencies over time. And he has stressed the building of trust among institutions and across countries. Florence Rolle from FAO has given us a view of what FAO does, in particular the Ethiopian response to the food crisis, what we have learned, and her question, as well as others, is how to sustain it in the long run. Let me open it for questions. If you come to the microphones, we will take them in order on arrival, back and forth. Can I ask you to give your name, identify yourself before you ask your question? Let's keep it as short as possible so we can get as many in as possible. Over here, please.
Research at ICRISAT, and I'd like to address my question to Rebecca Young. I'm not entirely sure that she was not overly supportive of the private sector and perhaps not sufficiently supportive of the public sector. And I wish to offer the example of finger millet, which she quoted. ICRISAT is the holds the world germplasm collection for finger millet. And up until the mid-2000s, the donor community was strident in their demands that that germplasm should be abandoned. And in fact, up until 2006, ICRISAT was unable to offer any support for finger millet. And finally, around that time, money was found that about one-third of one breeder would be allocated to this important crop. Now, if we're going to go down the track of advanced market commitment and make very nice offers to the private sector, we must also do the same to the public sector. If you're going to breed finger millet, you need time, you need breeders, and you need space. And I don't think we've had that yet, and I'd like to hear whether Rebecca feels that we've been fairly treated up till now.
Thank you for your comments, and I'll repeat again that what I presented was a very tiny slice of the solutions that are needed, and I do acknowledge the very critical and by and large the most important aspect of the investments will be public sector. And so the idea of an advanced market commitment would be a very niche area and very for applicable only in very certain cases. And so finger millet was an illustrative example, but perhaps in your greater knowledge in that field may not be the right one. I would like to say, though, one aspect of the advanced market commitment is not picking the winners, and so while it would be designed to hopefully bring in private sector resources, it wouldn't be limited to private sector innovators, so innovation would come from anywhere, and so different groups that do come forward with predefined solutions would conceivably be able to come forward.
Gordon.
Good morning. My name is Gordon Bacon. I'm with Pulse Canada. Doug, I'm going to direct my question to you just to not pick on the panelists, but perhaps the panelists will want to make a comment. I think one of the things that I haven't heard a lot about at this conference, or in fact the previous two, has been the role that trade in food needs to play as part of the global food security challenge and food solution. We had speakers yesterday. I think Mohammed talked about Middle East, North Africa importing food products equivalent to the total water flow of the Nile. I think we had speakers yesterday talk about the challenge of moving water and that rainfall isn't movable. Well, one of the things we haven't talked about is that you can grow crops in certain areas where Western Canada, Great Plains areas in Europe, in South America, in North America, and move it to food deficit regions. So I haven't also heard, panelists and sort of the development agencies talk about the linkages that should exist and the foundational investments that need to be made in some of these food exporting countries to be supportive of global food security opportunities. And I guess that's really my question is, have we not forgotten one important element, and that is some of the linkages that we can be making between investments in research and food development, nutritional security, environmental sustainability, in some of the food exporting areas, because clearly it is part of emergency food shortages, long-term food aid. And I think if we look to the long-term future of feeding 9 billion people, it will involve the trade of food from food surplus to food deficit areas. So I'll leave that as an observation, is that I think we haven't spoken about that role, an important role, because this in previous conferences has been described not as a food crisis but an income crisis, and we need to create wealth in order to allow people to buy the food that they need. And if we can produce that food in Canada or other areas to be exported to these regions, then that surely is part of the solution. But it isn't something yet we seem to be linking, and that's our investments in research in production surplus areas. And so if I'm going to phrase that as a question, then, Rebecca, it's going to go to you in finance and say, what's your you talked about decoupling of food aid payments, but is there a coupling that we need to see between investments in agricultural research as it relates to global food security?
Well, I think you make a good point, and today I can really speak to what I've presented, but acknowledge the importance, and that Canada in trade has certainly been a leader, for example, with its duty-free, quota-free measures recently. And I'd also like to acknowledge the work that CETA has been doing on aid for trade. And so I would say that, your point should be well taken, that in next year we certainly could speak more on what Canada is doing and what more we could do.
Chris?
In the policy advocacy or discussion business, really our currency are inconvenient facts, and which is to say I agree with you. One of the inconvenient facts is that for developing countries as a whole, over a recent 10-year period, if you take food staples, which is a little broader than grains, but developing countries as a whole on average imported 14% of their food staples. Now, there's, of course, a fair amount of variation across countries, and at the polar limit, you have the Haitis, Guinea-Bissau, Yemen, where it's 40%. But by and large, their developing countries are net food importers. And this means that they have – it means several things. One thing it means is that they have a tremendous interest in keeping food markets flowing well. And, in fact, traditionally, that was always – since – particularly in semi-arid areas of the world, own production is always variable. Depends on rainfall. It's going to get worse under climate change. And there's a tremendous – people have always used, regardless of where you were, international markets to provide sort of a cushion, and that used to be that you had large intervention stocks around the world, which really allowed many of the OECD countries to really be the seller of last resort. That's not there anymore, and that's why countries are having to rethink. Now, my last point, not to go on too long, is that one of the real conclusions is if you're dealing with places like most African countries, which has smallholder agriculture, that if you want to move them into markets out of subsistence, you're moving them into more risky things. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you can't do production without doing safety nets at the same time. Because this is an absolute critical thing. You must move together on both.
Just one point. I think what is also important to recognize is that these countries, some countries have a potential to produce much more than they are doing at the moment. It's just that there is no investment. So we cannot say today that, it's better to produce more in developed countries because we have already developed.
On the point Chris was making, which is the challenge for smallholders to access these international markets and the risk involved in that. We've been working with the World Food Program, who in recent years realized that it's the largest or one of the largest procurers of foodstuffs on the African continent, and has started to think about how to use that procurement in a more developmental for more developmental impact. And so we've started working with them to develop the farmer capacity to be able reliably to supply their procurement needs. So it's kind of a structured demand, but one of the ways that the smallholders can start to engage more in those kinds of international trade transactions.
Gordon, your question has stimulated a lot of response here. I'm going to take just a very brief moment because you did direct it at me as well. Number one, the price spike that we saw in 2007 and 2008 probably led to the greatest erosion in trust of the international trade system that we have seen in 20 to 30 years. That erosion of trust has led to a lack of political will in moving forward on either regional trade agreements or the WTO. What it has stimulated and accelerated is the purchase of resource base by countries with sovereign wealth funds, both public and private, in land, resources like fertilizer, energy, as a means of trying to avoid the lack of availability of product in a market when a crisis occurs. And it's largely because of that loss of trust. That needs to be addressed as we go forward. It's not about waiting on WTO until we rebuild it. We have to actively rebuild that trust so we can get to a trade liberalized world, particularly in food. Otherwise, you do not have the buffer systems anywhere in the world to contain the crises that we saw in 2007, 2008. Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. Sam Gamada, Agriculture Canada. My question, I'm sure you're aware of that, is to Madame Roll, but probably broader as well to others. It has to do with the issue of recipient countries either throwing roadblocks or resistance to some issues around policy, let's say, or decisions. And specifically, just to highlight a couple of things, one of the things that the Ethiopian government was doing was putting pressure on donors as to who they designate or how often they designate people chronically food insecure. And they wanted that number. They wanted to show that their policies were actually reducing that. But so there was that. And also the recent, in fact, it was in yesterday's Globe and Mail and also in the CBC, about the Human Rights Watch report about how they're using aid as basically a political influence. The other thing is, and a lot of these, and I'm glad to hear about the agricultural growth program and the emphasis that they're going to put on focus on productive regions. One thing I see is that the Ethiopian Institute for Agriculture Research is not, they're not pulling that in. They're working with the Ministry of Agriculture, the Extension Group, and all that. But the research group seems to be left out of all these initiatives that are taking place. So if you could comment on these. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. For the first comment, I can't say anything. I think, aid, I mean, you know, safety net program, targeting people, especially because there was the election in Ethiopia recently, so there was some evidence that aid was also used for political reasons. But, I mean, this is inevitable, I would say. But the second question on the research, I think it's very important because the research system in Ethiopia was very, very, very strong compared to other countries in Near East Africa. And but what it's not that research is left out at the moment. What the emphasis is on the linkages between research and extension, because research has been working in isolation, and they have developed in Ethiopia series of varieties which are on the shelves and not adopted by the farmers. So what the international community and the government is realizing that it needs to work on these linkages, university, extension, and farmers.
I'm going to take one more very short question. Let's over here.
Thank you. Harriet Kuhnlein. I'm a nutritionist with the Center for Indigenous Peoples, Nutrition and Environment here at McGill. And my question resounds around these issues of complexity that we've been talking about, and how we can get down to what are the real issues for the people that are directly involved in some of these crises, particularly those that are suffering from food and nutrition insecurity amongst the rural small holder farmers, as they're called. So in my view, there's a lot of knowledge and experience, and this has been alluded to. And there is also a need for in-country leadership to get the messages from the people to the decision-making forces. Now, I guess my question is, how can the UN agencies leverage countries to get the decision makers and their staff out of their comfortable capital city offices to the people to learn what it is they really want and what their priorities are? Because their priorities may not always be to make more money. Thank you.
Thanks for a very good question. And I think highlighting one of the challenges, both to mention the complexity. I think the challenge for us when we say raise our game is exactly that we have to manage this greater complexity in a way that responds to the political demands on one side and the realities on the ground on the other side. What I can say from IFAD's experience is that one of our hallmarks, we like to think, is that we're not the implementers, that they're not our projects, that the governments are borrowing the money. And so we've always worked closer to the ground, but with the ministries themselves. And consultation with the local communities is always a part of the development of the strategy, the identification of the priorities, and so on throughout the project. So I think that commitment to not be the actors, but to put the developing country governments at the front and to work alongside them, in our experience, has been one that has, I think, produced the kinds of results that you're suggesting.
You have an example?
Well, I mean, in each case, we work, typically there's a program implementation unit, and the situation that I, or the case that I visited most recently was in Guatemala, where we have a number of ongoing projects that over time we're trying to knit together into a countrywide program. But the staff that are the working on the project, running the project, you know, I've not met more dedicated, energetic, engaged individuals who would go to great lengths. And so, you know, they were young. Their commitment was quite obvious, and they were out in the fields on a regular basis working with people in the highlands, producers that have come together and formed producer organizations and with horticultural products are now actually supplying retail outlets in the U.S.
So I'll give you another example. I mean, I think the UN organization have a good play to role in that liaison between civil society organization or private sector organization and the government, because UN organization at the country level works day on a daily basis with the government. And I'll give you an example in Ethiopia. When we were preparing, I mean, when the government was preparing the strategic plan for the next 5 years, we had a huge consultative workshop. It's within the cadet process. You have to be, you know, very open. So, and we as UN organization, we had lots of dialogue with the government to push the government to introduce private sector organization, meat, dairy association, meat association, etc. So we did a lot. As a result, I mean, the workshop was a big workshop with more than 150 people, and the private sector was represented by five or ten of them, and the government was more than 100. But there is a role to play, and it's not something which happened overnight. I mean, you need a long process to make it happen.
Thank you. I'm going to stop questions there. As a note to Chandra, at a future conference, I think you need to consider looking at the topic of the public-private partnerships, given the interest in this panel. But those public-private partnerships have to include the foundations. It has to include the farmers, the recipient governments, as well as the donor governments and the multilateral agencies. It also has to involve the consumers in our rural and urban areas in the developing world. It's a matter of putting the pieces together, using the capital of all of the parties, and finding out how to do that will be difficult. It's going to take time. It's going to vary by location, but we do need it on the long-term commitments for success in rural and agriculture and food development. It also must include health, education, rural infrastructure, nutrition, all of those other things that this conference has brought together. Please show your appreciation to our speakers this morning. Thank you.